right, everyone. It is Tuesday, February 25th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Weather report from Concord, overcast, about 45 degrees, feels kind of balmy, a little scary. Anyway, this is an important day. And the reason it's an important day is because you have to watch the last debate before the South Carolina primary and the last debate before Super Tuesday. This is probably, if we know there were like 20 million people that watched the last debate because the billionaire Michael Bloomberg finally like revealed himself from behind his moat of money, tonight will be even more exciting because it really will be an opportunity for people to see whether that was a blip in Michael Bloomberg's inability to respond. I mean, he really did look like a deer in the headlights, or whether in fact, there is more to him than what we saw, and whether they will start attacking the leader in this race, which, of course, is Bernie Sanders. So before we call our first guest, everyone, I'm going to do something. I'm going to take a point of personal privilege. So a little bit of a history. I live in an 1890 Queen Anne Victorian. We bought this house from my aunt in 2009. She owned the house, and then when she died, she left me the house, and then within about 2 years of that, my husband died. So it was a house that I moved into. And for the first 5 years, it was more about taking care of people who I knew were going to be leaving me in short order. But the house has turned out to be a remarkable gift. I mean, an amazing gift. And I'm going to share one of the gifts of this house. So about a year and a half ago, I got contacted through Airbnb that a woman wanted to stay at my house. And I said, fine. She's from Connecticut. She runs all the museums in Connecticut. And what happened was that she comes to the house, and it turns out that in the 1960s, she and her sisters and brothers lived in that house. And it was an amazing home for them, but it was also, everyone, a tragic home for them because it was where their father left their mother. Well, over the course of time, we've become good friends. She is a historian. She's doing the history of the house. And she came last week to my house and spent 3 days. And during the course of the 3 days that she spent there, I said, Sally, when I was working on my attic, I found 150 letters. I know I put them in a safe place. I've got to find them. Sure enough, at 2 a.m, I suddenly remember where they were. And I went running down the stairs, pulled out the 150 letters, gave them to her, and she started to almost cry and said, this is amazing, Arnie. And I said, of all the people who should read these letters and tell their stories, it should be you, Sally. So before I grab my first guest, let me read you what she wrote, because she took the 150 letters home and put them on her dining room table. She writes the following. What a gift. I went to my childhood home, now owned by Arnie Arneson, for a 3-day Airbnb retreat. A few years back, Arnie found letters in the attic rafters, but couldn't remember where they were. During my visit, their location popped into her head. She ran into my room with her arms full of airmail letters from Grace Nelson in Pasadena to her sister-in-law, Maddie Nelson, in Concord, New Hampshire. She lived in our house. The 145 letters take us from 1928 to 1946. 145 slices of life, 145 reasons to thank Arnie for keeping the stories alive and creating new ones every day. Anyway, it's an amazing, amazing story. My house is remarkable. Sally is remarkable. And it's a piece of history that we're going to be retold, and then we're going to start making new history. All right. Joining us right now on the line is our first guest. Sorry for having you put up with my point of personal privilege, but it was just too perfect for me not to share with my audience. As I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, tonight will be the night where we're going to have the debate between Michael Bloomberg and the rest of the crowd. And the reason I say Michael Bloomberg is that if you were paying attention to the first debate with Michael Bloomberg on the set, what we knew was that Elizabeth Warren basically tore him a you-know-what and got into something called NDAs. And NDAs stand for non-disclosure agreements. I went to my favorite website, theconversation.com, and sure enough, there was an article. Non-disclosure and secrecy laws protect Bloomberg, not the women who sued them. We are very lucky to have Professor Elizabeth Tippett, who writes about ethics, employment law, and the intersection of law and technology. She teaches law at the University of Oregon, and I want to welcome her to the program. Thank you, Professor Tippett.
Hi, Arnie. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with sort of the basics. We know that I've heard of NDAs. I kind of knew what NDAs were. We all suddenly became very curious about them because Michael Bloomberg did not want to share a lot of information about them. So walk us through a little bit about what exactly they are, what is their history, and why we need to start paying attention to them, especially as they relate to a conversation we're going to probably be hearing happening over and over again with Michael Bloomberg, and maybe in some ways in light of what just happened with the Weinstein situation, because I'm sure he signed a lot of those as well. But walk us through and give us the, sort of the basics, because I think this is important, and also whether there is anything we can do to make sure they're not used in an abusive way.
Yeah, so if you are a worker, you would probably encounter a non-disclosure agreement in two different contexts. The first is often at the start of your job, they would ask you to sign an NDA, and those are really intended to protect trade secrets and confidential business information, but they tend to be pretty broadly worded, and so they might lead people to think, oh, you know, if I'm harassed at work or if I'm discriminated against at work, am I allowed to talk because I signed this NDA? So that's one problem that people encounter. The other time that NDAs show up is, let's say that you are leaving a job, or maybe you've threatened to sue the company over the treatment you received at work. When you settle that dispute with the company, sometimes those documents include a provision that might interfere with your ability to talk. So it might say you're not allowed to talk about the settlement, or you're not allowed to disparage the other party. That, I think, was what Elizabeth Warren was talking about in the debate involving Bloomberg, was settlements that Bloomberg had signed with presumably women who had sued Bloomberg personally or his company in the past.
So he said the other day that he would reveal three of the NDAs. He would admit to how many there were. He said he would reveal three. Were the three that he had that he was willing to share, were they with him personally, or were they with his Bloomberg media? I'm kind of curious about that. And he also kind of implied that this was a mutually agreed upon situation. And I'm kind of curious, as someone who teaches law and talks about NDAs, are they as mutual as Bloomberg asserted?
It can really vary. So often when you sign a settlement agreement, it's usually a non-disparagement provision, saying you can't say bad things about the other person or defame the other person, that prevents people from talking. And those are often mutual, but not always. They might only restrict the employee and not the company. It depends. So we don't really know what was in those documents that the litigant signed with Bloomberg or his company. And we don't really actually know which women it was. If you look at public filings, you can find a handful of lawsuits that involve Bloomberg. And during the debate, he talked about, you know, getting in trouble for some jokes he made in the 1990s, he said. I mean, they weren't really jokes. If you look at the lawsuits, they were, you know, pretty problematic comments about, mostly in the context of pregnant workers.
Yep.
So I suspect that's who he was talking about, was those lawsuits from the 1990s. There was also quite a large lawsuit brought against Bloomberg's company by the federal agency that enforces discrimination laws, and that involved about 70 workers who claimed pregnancy discrimination. But I don't know if there was a non-disclosure agreement for those workers. I suspect there actually is no non-disclosure for those workers, and those workers would be free to talk.
So I heard that Bloomberg's girlfriend was being interviewed maybe yesterday and said basically, oh, these are old, they're 30 years old, get over it, which I don't think really helped him very much. But what I'm trying to figure out is, Elizabeth Warren said the other day that she had written up a sort of a contract that would release everyone from this and offered to send it to him, you know, even maybe text it to him. I'm kind of curious, as we look at these things, what kind of advice would you be getting? And is there a way to create NDAs that will not be used in sort of a threatening way, so that you can't ask people, for example, to sign an NDA, which would be a law-breaking NDA, or an NDA that really sort of implied some kind of physical or sexual abuse? I think you mentioned in your article that the state of California has, in fact, tried to sort of suggest what is legal and illegal in an NDA.
Yeah, so several states have actually passed laws that limit your ability to enter into a settlement agreement that requires someone to stay quiet about their claims against the company. But those are of varying scope. So they might just be limited to sexual harassment cases in some states, or they might be limited to harassment and discrimination cases. And so if you bring a different kind of case, like a pregnancy discrimination case
that
or a retaliation case,
right.
That might actually not even be covered by the Me Too laws that allow you to speak. So part of it depends on, you know, what efforts your state has made to make it possible for people to speak.
Do you recommend that? Here's a couple of things. One, is it appropriate for the legislature to step in, number one? Number two, is there kind of like a draft bill that maybe you and some Me Too people could sit down and draft and say, look, we understand there's value to NDAs, but NDAs should not be used for X, Y, and Z, including things like pregnancy, because maybe if there's a woman sitting at the table, she might say, you know, what about if I'm pregnant? And I'm kind of curious whether it would make sense for legislatures around the country to begin to consider this, in part because now it's gotten to have such a high profile level, not only with the Me Too movement, but now with evil Michael Bloomberg, who basically is trying to buy his way to the presidency. We already know we have Donald Trump, who has an issue. You know, it's one thing to have the next billionaire with an issue. Is there a way for us to begin to rectify this in the future?
Well, I think there are some states that have regulated NDAs that you sign at the start of your job, and those actually have been pretty effective at forcing employers to say, oh, by the way, even though you're obligated to protect our trade secrets, if you experience unlawful activity in your job, you're still allowed to speak under the laws of this state. So I think those are really helpful for educating workers. The problem happens when you're dealing with these settlement agreements after a dispute already arises, because I think legislatures have decided that they don't want to ban secrecy in those contexts completely, and so they tend to include a bunch of loopholes that make it possible to still have secrecy. And I mean, I think that's a more difficult question, because sometimes people do want secrecy and they do want closure. So, I mean, I think legislatures are sort of trying to walk a fine line between making it possible for people to mutually agree to something and making sure people understand if there's a serious problem with the company and allowing people to speak out.
So I have to ask a question. How do you assume that there's a mutual agreement when there's such a power difference?
Yeah.
Bloomberg can destroy your life if he wants to, and the future of any kind of career. And I mean, that because I'm going to share a story. I'm not going to be specific with some of the facts because I can't hurt people. But I do remember someone approaching me a couple of months after an event. And she said, you know, he did, in fact, harass me. He did, in fact, do this. I did leave my husband for all these reasons. And I looked at her and I said, why didn't you come forward? Why are you telling me now about what happened about a year ago that could have had real consequences for an activity that I was involved in? Mm-hmm. And she said to me, you don't get it, Arnie. He destroyed my life once. If I went public, I would be destroyed again. And I think that that's part of the problem, which is one of the reasons why people may be willing to sign these NDAs, is that at least they get some protection. But if they do decide to come forward, that they feel like once again, they're going to be the more vulnerable party and the person who, you know, basically wants the NDA will not.
Yeah, I think it's tough. So states have tried various kinds of speed bumps to try and limit these types of agreements. So they'll say, oh, you have to give people 21 days to consider the agreement, and they can change their mind within 7 days. Sometimes states have said you can only sign these if the plaintiff requests it, which is a little bit hard to know what you really mean by request. Or sometimes you can only have it if they're represented by a lawyer. I don't think any of these things are perfect.
I don't think Elizabeth's going to bring it up again tonight. She might, but I there are so many places to go with Michael Bloomberg. I'm not sure that the NDAs is the only place I want to go. But as you heard that conversation last week before the Nevada debate, the Nevada caucus, what would you recommend that Michael Bloomberg do? I mean, is he in a no-win situation? Does he just basically say, sure, give me that piece of paper, I'll sign it? Is there any defense for him as long as he is not willing to release these people? That, to me, is the only real defense he has, because you know, then they have the option. They're the gatekeeper. He's not the gatekeeper. They are the gatekeeper. And I think the frustration that a lot of people have is, well, if it's nothing and these women really want it and you're not in a power position, then my recommendation is release them and let them make the determination whether they want their personal details made public.
Yeah, I suspect that, I mean, I think what he did was very shrewd because he claims to have released, you know, these three women and claims that's all there is. And he says he's going to do these different things going forward, but it's kind of limited. It only involves essentially sexual harassment claims when really, like, what he was mostly sued for was pregnancy. His company was mostly sued for pregnancy discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't really done anything about that in terms of letting people speak. I think he did enough to take the heat off of himself, and sort of the distinctions between what he is allowing people to talk about and what he isn't are so fine that it's going to be hard to make a lot of political hay out of it, because it starts to be kind of technical when you start to talk about what is the scope of what he's releasing. And so I think that was politically shrewd of him to say, well, I'm going to release these three women and you take my word for it that that's all there is.
So one more thing that we're talking about, because now we've been talking about Michael Bloomberg and we've been talking about non-disclosure agreements as it relates to some sort of sexual harassment. What about, since we've got people here who might be leaving jobs and there may be an NDA that they sign, what rights do they have? Because sometimes I think the NDA not only is something that you sign your life away more than just trying to protect the secrecy of the company. How do you know what is going to limit your sort of employment opportunities and what is going to protect your previous employer? They're not the same. And I think at the same time, sometimes it's hard to figure out what the hell did I sign?
Yeah. Well, if you're just regular, you're like, let's say you're laid off and they're offering you a little bit of severance in exchange for a release, I would look at that release and see if it has secrecy provisions about what you're allowed to talk about, or if it has any exceptions to that, or if it has a non-disparagement provision. But one option you always have if you're being asked to sign a release in exchange for severance is you can just decide you don't want the severance. You know, and the other thing is they can't really make you sign anything when you leave, because unless they're giving you money for it, there's no basis for the contract. So if you're walking out the door and they're saying sign this NDA, but they're not giving you any money, you have no reason to sign that.
All right, so now I'm going to ask a more difficult question, perhaps. One of the reasons why Michael Bloomberg has never showed his tax returns, by the way, I mean, he claims he did when he was the mayor of New York for 12 years, but it turns out he never did. And one of the rationales he uses is that it would reveal secret information about his company that would make him less competitive. So I guess here's the other question. What the hell is secrecy when it comes to a company? I mean, they get to determine what they consider secret. Do you get to determine? Do they flag you and say, by the way, these following activities are secret, you can't disclose them? Or are you supposed to somehow just know?
Yeah, that's tough. Actually, so the standard mostly is a trade secret. And a trade secret is non-public information that has economic value by virtue of being secret. And that sounds very broad, and that could include almost anything. And in fact, they don't need to tell you what all their trade secrets are in advance. That usually only comes up in litigation if they claim that you've stolen their trade secrets. And then they sort of decide that after the fact that you stole these things that we didn't even tell you these were trade secrets. But the secret about trade secrets is it's actually very narrow legal definition. It's actually really hard to prove something's a trade secret when you get into court. But before you get to that space, companies will claim everything's trade secret, everything's competitively valuable, you're leaving with the keys to the kingdom. That's sort of the standard claim.
Yeah, I want people to just hear this. That was what I was, I kind of assumed that, but again, once again, it's the power structure. You know, I used to work for a law firm that represented management. Didn't last long, trust me, I had to leave.
Uh-huh.
But there was no NDA when I left. But one of the things that was so interesting to me was that it was always the power team representing the employer, and then some guy with a scruffy shirt and a jacket that looked like it needed to be, like, repaired, that was representing the employee. And you're absolutely right. You know that story. And you see them throwing the book at them. And you know, the lawyer's like, looking like, oh, my God. And I'll never forget one of my management lawyers was saying, we can't look like we're too slick. We can't look like we know. We can't look like we know too much. Otherwise, the jury will go with him because they'll feel sorry for him. So I just thought I'd never heard that before. But I remember thinking, oh, my God, I want to remember this story. But again, that's part of what I want everyone to know. That is part of the problem in the employer-employee relationship. Is that even if you might have more rights, you almost assume that the employer has greater rights than you. And even if you have a leg to stand on, you don't even know that you do. And that's why one of the reasons why I wanted to ask that question about trade secrets, because as you just pointed out, it's really hard to prove.
I mean, part of the shell game of what companies do is they want to make it look like they have lots of rights and they have more rights than you do, because
yes,
they don't want you to do anything that would hurt their business interests. But like, the actual scope of their rights tends to be a lot less than what they claim.
So I just want everyone to know, we read a book that was called On Tyranny, and it's about authoritarians. It sounds so much like employers. Anyway, on that note, thank you, Professor Tippett. I really appreciate it. The title of her piece, Non-Disclosure and Secrecy Laws Protect Bloomberg, Not the Women Who Sued Him. So we know he released three. I guess a little question from Elizabeth, are there any more? Anyway, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Ernie.
All right. Before we end this half hour, though, I did something that I forgot. I forgot to begin the show with Colonel Vindman. And I promise that every single day we will be discussing and hearing the voice of Colonel Vindman as he testified before Congress. You didn't get him at 12:02. You're going to get him, however, at 12:25. Here he is, the voice of Colonel Vindman every day until election. No, Dad, it's not all right.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. I'm sorry I didn't start the show with that. I'm ending this half hour with that, but it's something that we need to hear over and over again as we see what's happening with the intelligence officers in Donald Trump's administration, as we watch what's going on with the manipulation in the Department of Justice. I almost think we need to have maybe we need to have some kind of a PSA or an ad or a commercial where he says, Dad, don't worry, it will be all right. And I think then you hear a voice saying, unless we replace Donald Trump, it won't be all right. That really is how I feel, because the more and more I look at his authoritarian nature, which is being given license by the spineless wonders that used to be called Republicans in the United States Senate, you do have to start asking yourself the question, you know, what is going to happen to our democracy? And I posted something interesting on about the coronavirus. I talk to my daughter every day because she lives in Shanghai. So here was the conversation this morning, everyone. This morning, they were talking about the fact that most companies will not go back online in Shanghai for 21 days. Do you know why? Because they want to see that there's not one outbreak in Shanghai for 21 days. And if there is not one outbreak, then they will open up the companies. What does that mean, however? Because we are connected, and we're now beginning to see a spike in the cases in Italy. We're seeing a spike in cases in Asia. And Donald Trump, of course, is getting up there and just assuring us that everything will be okay. And the problem is, I'm not sure how the liar in chief can be trusted that everything is going to be okay. And what I posted on Facebook was that, you know, before Donald Trump, we were going to be challenged by anything like a pandemic or an epidemic. And the reason is that we have a Swiss cheese kind of fabric when it comes to our healthcare system. We have a healthcare system that has people uninsured. We have a healthcare system where people are underinsured. We have a healthcare system where now, because of the public charge, people who are legal immigrants are going to be afraid to access things like Medicaid because they may never be able to get a green card or become a citizen. We have 11 million undocumented immigrants living in America who are afraid to go to a doctor, who will not tell you if they're sick. They also are now kind of ripe for the plucking. And then we have a public health system that is in failure. Colonel Vindman is right. It's okay, Dad. It'll be all right. But it will not be all right until we fix our healthcare system. It will not be all right until we remove this president. It will not be all right until we return to the rule of law. That is the problem. We were, you know, the shining city on the hill. But what have we become? We've become something so outrageous. And it's not that it was perfect before. It wasn't. We were sort of a level of imperfection, but it was one that maybe dreamed a better dream and hoped that their leaders would lead them there. The problem is we elected a leader who doesn't believe in that, who doesn't want to lead us there, who doesn't believe in the rule of law, who frankly has actually, he removed the head of sort of the global health pandemic. There was a guy in his administration. He removed him. He removed billions of dollars out of his 2021 budget that would deal with issues like this. This man has no concern for the future. This man basically wants to undermine us. Now the question is, what are we going to do about it? All right, everyone, a little labor history is next. Tomorrow, I promise, we begin with Colonel
Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day a general strike by workers against the Nazis took place in Amsterdam. The Nazis had begun the occupation of the Netherlands in the spring of 1940. The German occupiers implemented a series of increasingly repressive anti-Semitic laws. In response, some young Jewish men in the city formed self-defense groups. They clashed with the occupiers and local residents who supported the Nazis' policies. To make an example against Jewish resistance, on February 22nd, the Nazis rounded up more than 400 Jewish young men in Amsterdam. They were deported to a series of concentration camps where most were killed. The Communist Party in the city issued a call for workers to stand up against this anti-Semitism. Their call was to strike, strike, strike. Working groups across the city responded. The general strike began on this day in labor history, with public tram drivers leading the strike, causing public transportation to ground to a halt. Factories and department stores all stood silent. Students walked out of classrooms. The next day, the strike spread to other nearby towns and villages. The Germans' response was quick and harsh. It crushed the strike on its third day and leveled a severe blow to Dutch anti-Nazi resistance organizing. It's estimated that between 75 and 80% of the Netherlands' Jewish population perished in the Holocaust. In 1952, a large statue called the Dock Worker was commemorated in Amsterdam in memory of the workers' strike. Each year, a ceremony is held at the statue to recall when workers stood up together against hate and to renew the promise to never forget the victims of the Holocaust. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In parts of Canada and the northern U.S., winter means ice skating. Neighbors gather at frozen ponds or build homemade rinks in backyards and parks.
All the kids come by, and some of the adults as well, play a little hockey, just go for a skate, go inside for hot chocolates.
That's Robert McClemon of Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario. He says these skaters can see the effects of warmer winters firsthand. So he and his colleagues launched a website called RinkWatch. It invites people with backyard rinks to share their location, the date, and the skating conditions. By combining that data with climate models, the researchers can make predictions about the future of outdoor skating. For example, McClemon says Toronto and Montreal may lose 34% of their skating days within 70 years. He says not only are winters getting warmer,
but they're also starting to become more variable. So you'll get a lot of year-to-year swings in temperature that you never saw, say, in the 1950s and 60s.
He hopes that by connecting global warming to a favorite winter pastime, RinkWatch will motivate skaters to fight climate change.
To protect the outdoor skating experience really means tackling the root causes of climate change.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Name, please.
Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Just hand me my old Martin, for soon I will be starting back to dear old Charleston far away. Since Roosevelt's been reelected, we'll not be neglected. We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Back again.
Back again.
Back again.
Back again. Back again.
We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Since Roosevelt's been elected, moonshine liquor's been corrected. We've got legal wine, whiskey, beer, and gin.
Oh, God, what a great song, everyone. Thank you, Fred Portnoy. I'm sure you're the one that found that. Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. My next guest must be sitting there smiling, going, have I heard that song? Have I heard that song? Joining us right now from the LA Times is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Hitzig. He writes a blog at the LA Times. He's a business columnist. It appears in print every Sunday and occasionally every other day. And the reason why I so loved the piece you wrote at the LA Times, Michael, is I had tweeted something out the other day because I was so sick and tired of everybody going, you know, Democratic Socialist, Fidel Castro, calling Bernie everything a communist, whatever. And I'm like, oh, my God, have I heard this before? And before I allow you to open your mouth, let me share with you my tweet. I tweeted, to all those concerned about Bernie's past, remember when MLK was labeled an agitator and a socialist, Cesar Chavez a communist threat, and Nelson Mandela a terrorist, who frankly was still on the terrorist watch list till 2008. So been there, done that, heard that. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
It's a pleasure. So the reason why I am smiling and the reason why you got that song, it was in your honor, sir, was the piece that you wrote was, they tried to call FDR and the New Deal socialist too. Here's how he responded. And the reason why I'm so excited that you wrote this piece is you actually even wrote the book, The New Deal, A Modern History. So walk us through memory lane, because as I watch MSNBC and throw stuff at the TV set, I just want people to understand this is such a common refrain. And frankly, they don't even know what they're talking about. And if they look at their past, there is so much about who we are that has been labeled socialist that people adore, love, and never let go.
Well, yeah, my general take is that people who accuse various politicians of being socialists either don't understand the politician or they don't understand socialism. Now, Bernie Sanders, of course, identifies himself as a socialist, but I think his brand of socialism isn't really what most people think of.
Yes.
Most people think of socialism as a close cousin of communism. It really isn't, but it also doesn't bear much resemblance to Sanders' own policies.
Well, you know, let me just say something really quickly. So I totally agree with you. And I went to school in Minnesota at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. Which means I hung out with a lot of Norwegians and Swedes. So I decided I was going to look, because he's always referring to Finland and Denmark and Sweden and Norway. So I started like hanging out with my friends and starting to do a little bit of homework here, Michael. And let's talk about, I mean, in a way, this is a good way for us to distinguish between what Bernie says, what he's being accused of, and the reality of what he embraces and why they would want it too, is that when you look at their form of economies, it's called the Nordic model. And the Nordic model, by one of my friends who lives in Norway and actually works for the government, he said, actually, Arnie, we're more like compassionate capitalists, you know, with a strong social safety net. And I also did a little more homework. And do you know that there are more billionaires per capita in Sweden than there are in the United States? So as we look at what he points to, and as everyone is equating socialism with communism, why don't you take us through what they said about FDR, who basically is Saint FDR?
Right. Well, as you know, FDR really was focused on preserving capitalism. That's
yes.
what most of his
exactly.
New Deal programs aim to do. He was not about nationalizing industry. In fact, he had a close aide, Rex Tugwell, who did want to nationalize. He wanted to nationalize the banks during the bank crisis of 1933. FDR refused to do that and basically marginalized Hugwell, partially because of that. So FDR's policies, they were aimed, first of all, at preserving the industrial economy of the United States and also protecting individuals while the economy had a chance to recover. Mm-hmm. That was the goal of all of his employment programs, the Works Progress Administration, mm-hmm. The Public Works Administration, all that. The goal was just to enable American families to have food on the table and roof over their heads while the rest of the magic was designed to work.
So, but he was called a socialist for doing this. And I mean, so the thing is that if the word is used so often and misused so often, what happens to us? And of course, the problem is that Bernie embraces the term, maybe not in the way that people think about it. And how do we distinguish between the accusation of FDR being called a socialist, and you said he wanted to preserve capitalism? Then you've got Elizabeth Warren, who says she's a capitalist with a strong social safety net and wants to sort of establish parameters around big corporations. And then Bernie, who doesn't say either one of those things, who says, oh, no, I'm the democratic socialist. So I feel like I'm looking at the three faces of Eve, and I'm trying to figure out, is there a way for us to distinguish? And would Bernie be FDR-ish? Would Bernie be more into the idea of the aid that FDR didn't like, who wanted to maybe take over industry? I've never heard Bernie actually say that except for healthcare, which I'm kind of get along with. I'm just kind of curious, where does he fit in into the sort of continuum?
Well, you know, I don't think Bernie Sanders actually is talking about nationalizing healthcare in the way that we think about it, in the way that the American Medical Association attacked public health care back in the 40s and 50s. He's perfectly willing to allow private individuals and private hospitals to exist. What he's really talking about is having the government take a much stronger position in paying for all that care. That's not really socialism. That's Medicare.
Write that piece. I mean, but exactly what you said, nobody, I heard a conversation on NPR this morning. They didn't say that. It was a whole hour about Medicare for all, and they didn't say that. And I think one of the things that you probably know, Michael, because you do this for a living, you're the business writer, is that part of the problem with the healthcare system in America is we pay too much for everything. For everything. It's not just the paper care with insurance and profit. It's that when you look at a normal procedure, when you look at a drug, when you look at everything, I have no problem with the government saying we're going to pay for it, and I still have a private doctor or a private hospital. I just want someone to control those costs because I don't want to spend 10 times as much for a gallbladder as you would in any other country. Isn't that part of the reason why having one payer means you can negotiate price?
Well, that's part of it. And I think you put your finger on a key issue, and that is that it is how much we pay. In fact, one of the seminal papers on the problems with American healthcare, which was first written 20 years ago by an expert named Uwe Reinhardt, who unfortunately passed away in the last year. Yeah. The title of his piece was, "It's the Prices, Stupid." And that was his theme. And it's a theme that's been picked up by experts and healthcare and health economics for years now. Yes, we pay much more for procedures. We pay much more for hospital stays than any other developed country, and that is the core of the problem. And you're right. If we had a single payer, first of all, we would strip away a lot of the administrative nonsense that costs doctors and hospitals so much money. They have huge staffs to deal from. From insurers, if we didn't have the insurers taking such a strong position in the system, we wouldn't need those staffs. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, we would have a much greater ability to negotiate. We would have we would have much more transparency about what it costs and how that differs from what we charge to deliver care. So, yeah, one of the cores of Sanders' Medicare for All programs that he would bring down prices, that is, reimbursements for doctors and prices for hospitals to Medicare levels. And that's about 40% below what commercial insurers are paying.
So we're going to be looking at a number of other plans, and I'm hoping that they get beyond healthcare tonight, but they'll probably be discussing healthcare to some extent. So Kit, is there any other way of bringing down costs of drugs? Is there any other way of bringing down hospital costs and the costs of doctors without a single payer? I mean, I keep hearing, you know, Mayor Pete has, you know, Medicare for all who want it. But, you know, Bernie Sanders is, you know, he's off the charts. Then you've got Joe Biden basically saying, I'm going to improve on the public option and the Affordable Care Act. So I want you to be an honest business person. What is one, the most effective way of ensuring that we bring down costs? Is there any other approach other than single payer that could actually at least drain some of the excess dollars out of this? Part of the reason why people can't afford their 20% copay is when you're paying 10 times as much for the same procedure, 20% of that 10 times as much is the entire cost of the procedure in another country. I mean, let's wake up and smell the coffee, people. This is what's so wrong with it. So, Michael, if you had to evaluate other than single payer, what would be the way to sort of begin to sort of control those costs?
Sure. Well, you know, what I tell people, what I've written and what I said when I give talks out in the community is we're all really talking about the same goal, and that goal is universal health care and a much more efficient and rational system of paying for it. Now, one of the ideas that was part of Obamacare early on, but it fell away in the course of legislative compromising, is the public option.
Right.
And that is you actually set up a system, a public system that's paid for by the government to work as a competitor to the private system. And that alone would help bring prices down because the private system would have to strip away a lot of its excess costs and a lot of its excess pricing to compete with the public option. So that's one thing. You know, there's almost an infinite number of ways that you can get to the goal. And we can try them all, or we can even try a lot of them at once. It doesn't have to be Medicare for all, which I think is sort of a label that doesn't necessarily get to what the goal is. And it's a convenient label because people love Medicare.
Right.
I certainly know a lot of families and a lot of individuals in the U.S. who are in their 60s who can't wait to reach the age of 65 so they can go on Medicare. It's cheaper. It's more comprehensive. It's not perfect. And there would have to be a lot of things that would have to be changed if it became the system for everybody at every age. But it's a much more rational system. It's much more efficient. Its administrative costs are rock bottom. So we're really talking about how do we get there? And, you know, there are any number of paths, really an infinite number of paths to get here or there. And that would be worked out in the political process, the legislative process. So I think it's a mistake to sort of focus on what's the actual system going to be and what are the details. It's much too early in that process.
Well,
what we need is for everybody to come together and support the goal and understand the goal, which is to bring health coverage to everybody in America.
So in a lot of ways, I just did an interview on Newsy.com, and they were asking me about, you know, whether Bernie could get this and Bernie doesn't compromise and all this other horse crap. And so I said, look, I've known Bernie since he was mayor of Burlington, Vermont. I mean, I really do know him. And I said, and you know what? He compromised as mayor. Ask the business community in Burlington. He compromised when he was in Congress. He voted for the Affordable Care Act. If he was such a damn purist, why would he have voted for the Affordable Care Act? So he gets it. And I said, I think the difference between the Bernie that you're afraid of and the reality of the Bernie is that what Bernie won't do is he won't pre-compromise. He compromises at the end of the fight, at the end of the conversation, but not at the very beginning of the conversation. So I do have to ask you this, Michael, since you do look at this a lot, and that is the idea of the public option as maybe an answer. So here's my biggest fear. What do we know about Medicare and Medicaid? And I've said this for decades, that Medicare and Medicaid was a gift to the insurance industry. Why? Because we took the old dying people off their backs and we took the poor dying people off their backs. So if you were poor, you were on Medicaid. If you were in a nursing home, you were on Medicaid. If you were getting old at 65 and getting every kind of disease known to man because you never took care of yourself, you were on Medicare. So what did that leave the insurance companies? Exactly what they wanted. Healthy people that don't get sick. I mean, for the most part, that was what they wanted. And my fear about the public option, which is that the government will step in, is that the people that will exercise the choice of the public option will not be the healthiest people. It'll be the least healthy people, because it will look like a reasonable cost. Because what the private insurance companies can do is then really cherry pick what's left and get the young, healthy people to go into quote unquote private insurance at what it looks like a reasonable cost, because they know that they won't cost them anything. So once again, the government is paying for the most expensive aspects of covering people, and the young, healthy people aren't part of the system. Don't
well,
you want them there?
You know, what I would say about that is I'm not sure why we should fear that and why we shouldn't be okay with that happening. Look, if the public option is properly funded and can provide all these services, then fine. Then if the sickest people gravitate toward it, that's okay. That would actually force down premiums for everybody else, because insurance companies wouldn't be bound to cover the most expensive patients. So fine. I just don't see why we should be afraid of that.
Well, I want to get into the second article, but let me just stop you there. So in order to be on the government teat, in order to be part of the government healthcare system, we're going to pay for the old and the sick, and we're going to let private insurance companies make their profits on the young and the healthy. What's the concept of insurance? Isn't the concept of insurance the young take care of the old, the healthy take care of the sick? That isn't that the concept is that you want a diverse pool within your insurance pool in order for it to be affordable. If we keep dumping more and more sick people on the government, that's only bad for the sick people. They'll start draining some of the dollars out of the generic Medicare.
Well, but why is it bad for the sick people if they're treated and they get the treatment they need? I'm not sure it matters that we have the government paying for it. I mean, that is the concept of Medicare. As you pointed out, the government covers them. I mean, there are premiums that individuals have to pay, although they're relatively low for
right.
most people.
Right.
But they do get care, and they know going in what care they're going to get. They know where the gaps are, and many of them buy gap insurance to cover that.
Right.
In fact, if you look at, for example, people with end-stage renal disease, these are people
right.
who had to go on dialysis. Well, in the 1970s, it became clear that dialysis patients could not get insured.
Of course.
So Congress found it out. They basically said, if you're on dialysis, whatever your age, you will be going on Medicare, and Medicare will pay for your dialysis. And that worked very, very well. And it was necessary right up until Obamacare came in. But it worked perfectly well for those patients. They got their dialysis. They didn't have huge out-of-pocket
right.
Expenses, and they were invulnerable to being barred by insurance companies and left out in the cold.
So I will end the conversation with this. So you want government to pay for all those sick people, whether they're old sick people, young sick people, or medium-sized sick people, and you don't think that allowing the government to pay for the most expensive aspect of healthcare without any of the benefits of the least expensive aspect of healthcare, but leaving the least expensive aspect of healthcare to the for-profit insurance companies who will make even more profits because they only have healthy people in their pool, that's good for maintaining a system that will continue to take care of all of us without draining the revenues and having people like, the Trumps and maybe even the Bloombergs raising questions about the fact that we really can't afford that Social Security. We really can't afford
well,
that.
Well, look, we can afford it. We know we can afford it. I don't think that's the issue. And I think this is a process. I mean, we're not going to change the American healthcare system overnight. We're probably not going to change it in less than 10 years. So it's going to evolve. But once you have a public option, that's going to become more and more important, because
right.
people will gravitate toward it. And look, if it allows or prompts commercial insurance companies to reduce their rates, that's good. And if it prompts private insurance companies to force down what they are reimbursing to doctors
right.
and to hospitals because they need to compete, That's good. So I think you're sort of focusing on the wrong thing. Yes, it's probably true that the sickest patients and the older patients will gravitate toward the public option. Of course, it depends on what the public option covers and how.
Right.
But if that's so, and it leaves the healthiest patients in the hands of private insurers, we already have a law that governs how much private insurers have to spend on healthcare out of all the money they make.
Right.
And if they're spending less, they're going to have to reduce their premiums.
Right.
Otherwise, they're going to be violating the law, and we'll enforce it. So it's good. I think if people see that the public option is a suitable alternative to putting everybody on Medicare, then I think that's a good thing, and that's very much a step in the right direction.
So I was talking to a friend about the public option who owns a small business, and he said, you know what, Arnie? If there was a public option, I'd say forget that insurance plan. You guys go in the public option. I don't want to deal with insurance companies. I don't want to insure people anymore. I'll pay you your wages. You deal with the healthcare. And the public option, I think there is some potential here. And a lot of what we're discussing
here.
Well,
I'm not sure it's going to be that simple because, look, we already have under the Affordable Care Act, we have a rule that says if it were ever enforced, that if you are a business of a certain size, then you actually have to contribute to the cost of bringing insurance to your employees. It's going to be the government's decision, Congress's decision, whether to let employers off the hook or to require them to actually provide. But let's not forget that what employers pay today to cover their employees actually comes out of the employees' wages one way or another because essentially the employers know, and they most of them tell their employees, here's how much we're contributing for your health insurance.
Right, it's part of your compensation. You know. And they call it the compensation package. That's part of the problem. And I think,
well, it is.
I totally get it. And I think what's so interesting is that kind of employees know that, even if their union bosses don't, is that what you saw in Nevada was that despite the fact that the Culinary Workers Union basically kind of poo-pooed Bernie Sanders and his Medicare for All, even though those people have good health insurance plans, they still said, you know, but I've lost my job. I can't afford COBRA. My niece doesn't have health insurance because she's not part of the Culinary Union. And they suddenly decided that they wanted to go with the idea of Medicare for All because they understand that it is eating away at their wages on an annual basis. And unfortunately, their rent isn't going down. Their food isn't going down. The cost of their energy bills aren't going down. But they don't see a bill that's coming in from their employer in the form of a wage, what they do say is, oh, but we're covering more and more of your health insurance. But how often do you get sick? I mean, let's be honest. You have to pay the rent every month. You may get sick twice a year. And I think that's where people are beginning to understand that this is eroding their wages. And that's something they need to be concerned about.
Right. Well, I think people understand that.
Yeah. Last but not least, we got 2 minutes. So tell me, Bloomberg's record on Social Security, shouldn't trust them?
Well, it certainly hasn't been a great record. He has criticized Social Security in some pretty ignorant ways. He's claimed more recently that he will support Social Security. Well, you know, he's got to do that if he wants to win the Democratic nomination. But his rhetoric in the past has not been encouraging.
Well, I think his rhetoric on the past and a lot of things have not been encouraging. And it shows
Fair
the desperation
enough.
Of the Democratic Party. Just take this burden from us and buy it. It's kind of amazing anyway. Michael, thank you so much. I love this testy conversation. Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Michael Hitzig writes for the LA Times. His piece, they tried to call FDR and the New Deal socialist. Here's how he responded. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
All right. Ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone, we're going to end with Baby, You're a Rich Man. Do I dedicate this to Donald Trump or is he a faux billionaire? Do I dedicate this to Michael Bloomberg? He's got 60 billion. Do I dedicate this to Tom Steyer? I don't know how many billion. But here's the most important question, everyone. If you become president, will there be more billionaires after you're elected?
How does it feel? let you know who you are. What do you want to be? And have you traveled very far?
Change your mind.